take appearances of counsel in the matter of State versus William Jarena.
Melanie Delplane, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, representing William Jarena. And at the outset, I'd like to request a few minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Assistant Prosecutor Stephanie Davis-Elson, Hudson County Prosecutor's Office, on behalf of the state.
Deputy Attorney General Frank Murawski, on behalf of the Attorney General, as amicus curiae.
Ms. Simon, want to enter your appearance?
Good afternoon, Justices. This is Rachel Simon from Pashman Stein on behalf of Amicus Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Start with Ms. Delplane. Please proceed.
May it please the court. This case is about the injustice of using unreliable lay testimony as the sole evidence to secure a conviction. A person's age is incredibly difficult to estimate. Even though people estimate others' ages frequently in their everyday lives, their guesses as to a person's age are often wildly inaccurate. These unreliable guesses should not be admitted as evidence in court to prove an essential element of an offense, particularly given that it is easy to learn a person's actual age. In Mr. Jarena's case, there were four police officers who arrived at the scene. Only two of them were involved in Mr. Jarena's arrest. And yet none of the four officers spoke with anyone at the scene or even photographed anyone at the scene to learn the ages of the children for certain. There were no attempts to obtain concrete evidence of age. At trial, the state's only evidence that there were children under 13 years old was unreliable testimony from two lay witnesses. This court should find that the lay testimony on age should not have been admitted, given its unreliable nature, and reverse the appellate division's decision. Today, there are four points that I want to highlight. First, lay testimony on age is not helpful to a jury because it is unreliable. Second, contrary to the state's position, this case is not only about witnesses estimating a person's exact age. Rather, estimates of ages are also unreliable, even if framed as a range of ages. Third, even when a child appears to be well below the threshold age of 13 years old, it is still surprisingly difficult to estimate their age, so jurors should be permitted to draw their own conclusions about age based on the concrete information before them. Last, if this court does allow lay testimony on age to sometimes be admitted, the appellate division's eight-factor test should be modified to comport with the relevant social science findings on age estimates. This concludes my opening.
So is it always difficult to estimate age or to estimate a range of age? Suppose you have a group of just toddlers and their parents on a playground. Is it too speculative to allow a witness to estimate the age of the toddlers?
It would be too speculative to allow a witness to estimate the exact age of a toddler. But if the witness were to say that they saw a baby or someone who they thought appeared to be young, given specific facts that they witnessed at the scene, like the baby had a pacifier in their mouth or there was a baby carriage around, that would be permissible. But to say that there was a child who looked to be 3 years old, that would still be too speculative.
And how about if they were a little older than just an infant with a pacifier? You have a group of children that appear to be kindergartners, and a case where the relevant threshold is age 13. Would it be too unreliable, too speculative to allow layperson testimony about a range of ages for those kindergartners?
Yes, it would be. In this case, the two lay witnesses, the AG, the girl who called 911, and the police officer, they had conflicting testimony about someone who may or may not have been a toddler. AG, she testified that the lowest age that she saw was 3 years old, while the police officer said that the lowest age he saw was 6 years old.
So stop there, because I wasn't so much focused on the evidence in this case, as opposed to the broad rule that you've advocated for, that this is never reliable information. Why is that so when we're dealing with ages at the opposite ends of the spectrum, someone very old, someone very young? If the threshold is to determine age 13.
It's witnesses, if they were to give an estimate on the exact age of, as you mentioned, someone who appeared to be in kindergarten, this would still be too speculative, because even though they might appear to be under 13 because they appeared well below the threshold, the witness wouldn't know with certainty what specific age they were.
So let's stay away from specific age,
okay,
and focus on a range of ages. Why would it be so unreliable as to be inadmissible for a competent witness to present a range of ages for a group of kindergartners?
Because even when they present a they testify as to a range of ages, it's the social science shows that people are really bad at estimating ages at all sorts of stages.
Does the social science support that for ages at the outer ends of the spectrum?
So the social science studies that I looked at did not look at those extremes. They looked at people who were more in the middle, adults, but.
Well, use your common sense for a moment, because when we talk about lay testimony, we don't even have to look at the social science. The statute just requires that the person be under the age of 13. So if the person testifies that I think the person was 5 years old, most people can tell the difference between a 5-year-old and a 13-year-old. Would you not agree with that? Or some, the person might be 4, maybe 6, maybe 3, maybe 7, but not 13. Would you agree?
I'm hesitant to agree, because although from a common sense standpoint, it's tempting to say that someone who was 5 years old could surely, or who looked.
You don't have to, the statute only requires that the person be under 13 years old. So the question is, can you determine beyond a reasonable doubt the person is under 13? And so if the person thinks, the person looks around 5 years old, this is what the Chief Justice was saying, at the extremes. That's a lot different from a 13-year-old, nowhere near a 13-year-old. Would you agree?
Yes, but it's difficult to draw a line. And so if you were to allow estimating that there was a, say, 3-year-old, someone to say that there was a 3-year-old.
You don't have all the witness, and at the end of the day, all the jury has determined the person beyond a reasonable doubt was under the age of 13. Even if the person is off about 5, the question is, beyond reasonable doubt, is the person under 13? And is that acceptable lay witness testimony? When the person appears to be 5 years old. Could be 3, could be 7.
Is your question whether a lay witness could testify that they saw someone who appeared to be 5, or is it that they would be able to testify that they were under 13?
Well, the statute requires a person to be under the age of 13. So as long as that element is satisfied, that's all the jury has to decide. Now maybe lay testimony wouldn't be permitted when someone appears to be around the age of 13. Could be 10, could be 15, or whatever. But when you get to the extremes, as the Chief Justice was suggesting, then people know. Do you disagree with that notion?
I agree that at the extremes, people can tell. But again, it becomes difficult about where you draw the line, because someone who testified that they saw, as in this case, a 6-year-old, someone else could testify that they saw a 3-year-old. And these are two very different stages of life, even though it's only 3 years difference.
And both of them meet the statute. Both of those meet the statute. The jury could decide, in this case, between the police officer and the young woman who was walking her dog, that one was more credible than the other, and the youngest child there may have been 6, or the youngest child may have been 3. But it seems like what you are saying is that you need more than lay opinion testimony to decide whether someone is a child or a teenager. And that's a big leap you're taking, I would respectfully suggest.
What I'm saying is that if two people could find a child to be of different stages of life, 3 versus 6, then a 6-year-old could also be mistaken as being, say, 10 years old. And so it's difficult to draw the line, because if you said that you saw a person who appeared to be, say, 8 years old, and that seemed to be well below the threshold of 13 years old, another witness could see that same child who appeared to be 8 years old to one person.
We're talking about admissibility of evidence here. It could be cross-examination. You could cross-examine both witnesses and show the discrepancies between their testimony and that they were uncertain of the exact age. We're talking about the admissibility of testimony here. It's a Rule 701 issue.
Yes.
So you seem to be saying, because other witnesses might estimate the age a little bit differently, that means that none of that is admissible?
I'm saying that the witnesses were permitted to testify about what they saw at the scene, such as what activities the children were engaging in, whether or not what clothing they were wearing, if they heard their voices, and if the voices sounded high-pitched or lower. There were a lot of things the witnesses could have testified about, but when they testified about their perception of the children's ages, this testimony was very speculative and unreliable, as our courts have found for 100 years.
So you raise, I think, a stronger argument for a child that is close in age to the 13-year mark. Let's assume, hypothetically, that we know there's one person and that person is 12 and a half years old. There would be a strong argument on reliability grounds as to whether a passerby should be permitted to say, I think that person was anywhere from 12 to 14 years old. A stronger argument than the one being advanced in the case of a toddler or a kindergartner. Wouldn't the better course be to require a 104 hearing, have the judge make a determination based on what is presented, what corroborative information is presented, similar to some of the factors laid out in the appellate division decision, and then rule on admissibility and say, in the case of a 12 and a half year old, you've got to bring in an expert. Lay opinion testimony is too speculative and too unreliable in that particular instance, but not so in the case of the 5-year old, the kindergartner, the 4 to 6-year old. Would that construct make more sense than just simply abolishing this testimony across the board?
I agree that if this court were to find that lay testimony on age is sometimes admissible, then your course of action would be would make sense to have a 104 hearing to determine whether or not the testimony should be admitted in a particular instance. And I also want to highlight that here, it was very easy. It would have been easy to learn the ages for certain. And so the police had opportunities. They had the opportunity to obtain contact information from the parents to follow up later and find for certain what the ages of the children were. Even if the parents had left the scene, the witnesses were still permitted to testify about what they saw. My argument is just that when it came to their estimates of the ages, that's when it became unreliable. But they could have said that they saw children playing on slides, on swings, and then let the jury determine for itself what age they thought the children were, as that is the role of the jury, is as fact finder. And we've already found this in other cases, like in State v. McLean, where this court found that the jurors are to determine whether, like, they are to determine an ultimate issue as to guilt or innocence, even if it seems a bit repetitive or pedantic to say each of the little facts when you think that a witness could just give a summary of their views as to the age. Because this court has found that it's unreliable, and because the social science has found that age estimates are unreliable, this should be for the jury to determine. Moving to my next point, I wanted to talk about the appellate division's eight-factor test, and which, if this court were to find that lay testimony is sometimes admissible and sometimes not admissible, which factors I think are appropriate to keep and which ones I think should be added or modified. So as to the factors I think would be appropriate to keep, that would be distance, duration, the conduct of the people observed, the relative age and height of the witness compared to the child, corroborating proofs, and totality of the circumstances. And so these factors, I think, are all supported by the social science findings on what leads to a person's estimate of age and its accuracy.
Which ones did you take out? Which numbers did you not want us to rely upon?
The physical comparisons with nearby objects and other people, because when you're comparing your estimate to another object or person, you are also estimating your comparison point.
It's not valid to consider that the child came up to the waist of an adult who was standing by. That's not a relevant consideration in terms of height, that the child's height was only half the height of an adult.
I was just saying that if
someone's half, if there's a person playing on a playground and they are only come up to the waist of the adults who are present, or they come up, or they're shorter than that, isn't that strong evidence that we're dealing with a child?
So that would go to the relative, if I'm understanding your question, I think that would go to the relative age and height of the witness compared to the child. If the
physically, you want to jettison physical comparisons with the height or size of nearby objects or other persons? I'm sorry, tell me if I misheard you.
So I was referring to number four.
Yeah.
But there's an additional factor that the appellate division set forth. Number six, whether the observed individual has a comparatively similar age or height as the witness.
So which ones do you want to get rid of?
Four.
Four,
just
right.
Just number four or anybody?
Number four, and also... also, whether witnesses attest to a range as opposed to a specific age.
You would get rid of that?
Yes, because the ends of the age range that was estimated would still be speculative and would still be unreliable.
I thought you were previously arguing against the specific age.
Right.
Now you're arguing against a range as well?
Yes.
So what would the witness be permitted to say?
If it was a baby, they could say that it appeared to be a very young infant, given the various things that they witnessed, like a baby carriage or a pacifier. Or if it was someone who was in their 80s, roughly, could say that it was someone who appeared to be elderly, given they had.
How's the jury going to know what one person thinks is a baby and another person isn't? Mm-hmm. And even babies have age ranges, no?
Babies do have age ranges, but the range is still speculative and still unreliable, either end of the range.
So, but in this instance, there were two witnesses who were saying that there were children under the age of six. In fact, some said between four and six. You don't think that range would be a good starting point for a judge to focus on in a 104 hearing? You would disqualify that testimony because it's a range?
Yes. If this court were to find that lay testimony on age is sometimes admissible, then yes, that would be a good starting point at a 104 hearing.
It would be a good starting point.
Yes, but if the jury were to hear the specific ages, as in this case, even if it was a range.
If you can't have a range or a specific age under your, what do you have? What can the witness say? You can't give a range. You can't give a specific age. What can the witness testify to under your construct?
Under my construct, you would be able to testify about the activities that the children were engaging in.
Okay. Is there a difference between a 6-year-old kid kicking a soccer ball around or a 13-year-old kid kicking a soccer ball around?
That would be for the jury to decide.
So you're just supposed to say, allow them to say, I saw a young person doing some things on a playground playing, and that's it?
Yes, essentially. But again, the police were still, they were permitted to find additional evidence, and they didn't. They could have obtained more evidence.
There was some evidence that people got concerned because police officers showed up. And they took their kids and left.
There's nothing in the record that discusses whether or why.
This isn't a case where there's an allegation of bad faith on the part of the police. We're trying to determine the rule for admissibility of evidence. So what the police could or couldn't have done doesn't necessarily help answer that question. Would you agree?
That's correct. Yes.
All right.
So with regard to factor number four. You're suggesting that is also not a factor that should be considered. So, and if I understand what you, I think you started responding to Justice Patterson was that if a witness is comparing the size of the child to another person or some other object, then they may be speculating as to the size of that other person as well. But what about objects with standard heights? I mean, if a child is standing next to a mailbox, they're all the same height. They wouldn't be able to say, well, this child must have been, 2 or 3 years old because they were shorter than the mailbox, or a park bench, or something that has a standard height that's common. I'm trying to understand why that comparison to in factor four would be inappropriate.
So yes, so I think that would be appropriate. My issue with the factor as it is I think it is not clear enough. So it allows for the potential to compare, to make an additional estimate of age or height. But if it were something like that, like comparing a child's height to a mailbox, which is
at the beginning of your argument, you suggested that the police did nothing. They could have taken photographs of the children. Do you think that parents might have some concerns that a police officer comes up and starts taking photographs of their children and some prosecution? And the photographs, how would they provide more accurate information than the witnesses who actually saw the people? You have a photograph, you have nothing to compare it to. Assuming the parents would line up their children to be allowed to be photographed for some investigation, which I suspect would be very difficult. Assuming that happened, how can a photograph, given a photograph to a jury of an individual with nothing around it to compare it, nothing, how could that possibly be more helpful than the witnesses testifying as to their size and their relationship to different objects or to each other? How can a photograph be more helpful or more accurate than testimony from a witness?
So first, I want to respond to your point about parents maybe not wanting their children to be photographed. Police regularly wear body cams, and so had they worn body cams in this case and gotten some children in front of their view, that would have been admissible evidence.
How would that help with the age of a person, a body cam photo, as opposed to a description from someone comparing the person to other objects, to other individuals? How could a body cam shot provide more accurate information than testimony from two witnesses? All it is a shot of a photograph. I mean, photographs can be enlarged. They've been shot, cropped. How can that provide more information?
It's more information because the jurors would then have more time to look at the photos. In this case, it's not specified how long either witness was able to observe the scene, but there were at least 15 children. They both testified as to there being 15 children, roughly. And so it could have been this hectic scene where, you know, there were a lot of people running around and they couldn't get a very good view. Whereas if you had a photo that you presented to the jury, they would be able to spend more time with that photo and make a more accurate assessment of age. And it's also, it's the jury's role to do that. It's not the lay witness's role to give an unreliable estimate.
So you've given us your assessment of the eight factors. Is there something in addition you'd like to present to the court?
Yes, so I would also suggest that additional factors would be added to the test. One would be the race of the witness, as well as the race of the person that they were estimating. Whether or not the witnesses could see the person's eye regions, or their face, but one of the studies talked about their eye region specifically being a strong indicator of the accuracy of an age estimate. The clothing of the children, and then also whether or not the witnesses could hear the children's voices.
What was the last one? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What was the last one?
Whether or not the witnesses could hear the voices of the people they were estimating.
Okay.
So if they can't hear the voices, the testimony should not be admissible?
No, it would just be one additional factor.
Okay.
When looking at the totality.
Got it.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Go
ahead.
In conclusion, lay testimony on age is unreliable and should not be admissible to prove an essential element of an offense. However, if this court does find that lay testimony on age may sometimes be admitted, courts should only admit such lay testimony when it is found to be sufficiently reliable given relevant social science findings. Thus, the appellate division decision should be reversed.
Thank you. Ms. Simon.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Justices. I'd like to start by thanking the court and its staff for accommodating my medical condition on short notice. I was unable to travel to and from Trenton today, so I hope that nonetheless, despite my limitations, I will assist the court in its contemplation of this case today. To that end, this afternoon, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey has three requests of this court. First, to reverse the appellate division and reaffirm the longstanding bar against age opinion testimony. Second, to disallow the changing of our evidence rules mid-proceeding, particularly to correct trial errors by the state. And third, only in the alternative, if the court is inclined to depart from prior precedent, overturn the longstanding bar, and adopt a multi-factor test, ACDL requests that appropriate subject matter experts be consulted as part of the drafting process, that the test proposed by the appellate division does not capture current and applicable science.
Can you repeat that last part, after subject matter experts?
A coalition of subject matter experts and stakeholders be brought together, a la Henderson or Andujar or any number of the court's other mechanisms, in order to draft an appropriate multi-factor test that captures all of the current and applicable science.
Thank you.
Sure. On the first point.
Is there social science out there that says that people are generally unable to distinguish 5-year-olds from 13-year-olds? I think what we're hearing is there's social science that may make it difficult for people, depending on the circumstance, to decide somebody's 46 years old when they might actually be 37 years old. But is there social science that says that human beings are generally unable to accurately decide if a person is 5 or 13?
Thank you, Justice. I'm not aware of any study that would be that specific. What I can tell you is this review of social science that I have done as part of this matter says that at least three studies from 2017, 2018, and 2020 found that the average rate of error in guessing another person's age, and this is across the span of ages, is 8 years. Further, however, one statistic of significance is that two different studies in 2017 and 18 found that the accuracy of estimating the age of a child drops to 33% when that child is a stranger. That means that our estimation of a child's age is more likely to be inaccurate than accurate.
I don't think that's telling us much. It's not being able to tell the difference between a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old is different from being able to tell the difference between a 5-year-old and a 13-year-old. And telling us that people can't determine within 8 years is different between someone who may be 34 and 42. When you get into those developmental ages, most people can tell whether someone is in a category. I'm not talking about an age, whether a person is a toddler or a teenager. Would you agree?
I would agree with that, Justice. I would agree that a stranger is able to determine the, I guess, pubertal developmental stage of a particular, of another stranger, whether they're a toddler, an infant, an octogenarian, you know, without reference to a specific age number. And for the associations part, I believe it answers, you know, sort of the question that was repeated to my co-counsel, Ms. Del Plain, which is, you know, where is the line? What can someone testify to? And why isn't testimony at the extremes reliable? And my answer is this. There is a difference between someone's appearance and their year, the year of their birth. Someone's birth year is an invisible trait. Their state of maturation is visible. A lay witness should be permitted to testify to their observations. They should be able to testify to whether or not someone was a baby or an infant or a toddler in their view. And that's as far as an opinion could be considered reliable in this realm. Once you attempt to attach a number to it, you have run afoul of the innumerable intrinsic and extrinsic factors identified by scientists, social scientists.
The Chief Justice started out his questioning with the extremes. Would you agree that the difference between a 5-year-old and a 13-year-old are extreme? Those are at the extremes. Would you agree?
I would agree, yes. Yes, Justice.
So under this statute, a person is culpable if the child is under the age of 13. So if you have a witness saying, I know the person was under the age of 13 because the person looked as though he or she was 5 years old. Admissible?
No, Justice. I think where the line is, the person could testify, I saw a child.
Child?
I saw a 5-year-old. Not I saw a child under 13.
What's a child? What's a child?
That's for the jury to make a reasonable inference from.
Well, do you know what a child is? Help us out. What's a child?
Well, Justice, if I were on the jury, I would infer that if a witness testified that they observed a child, I would infer that the word child meant under 13. I would infer that someone would use the word teenager if they meant someone over the age of 13. But that's me, and that's not a jury. It's the province, as Ms. Del Plain said, it's the province of the jury. And to Justice Fernandez-Vina's question about a photograph, I actually believe that's the distinction that Judge Sabatino made between this case and the May case, on which he relied in saying that 701 has a flexible approach. The May case was a child pornography case. And in that case, the court permitted the jury to look at the pictures and determine for themselves whether or not the children were above in the age range of liability or not. And so I think that's exactly the same here, is that that's the difference, is that the jury is allowed to take objective facts and draw reasonable inferences from those facts.
Would that be the only requirement then, excluding everything else, just photographs, no description by the witness, there's no explanation by the witness, he came up to the waist of another child, or he came up only to the waist of an adult, he had features that were more childlike, a little chubbier than a teenager. None of that would be allowed. The only thing would be give the jury a photograph and let them figure it out.
Oh, no, Justice. I believe the any testimony as to the witness's observations is admissible. It's when the witness draws a speculative opinion.
If any testimony is admissible, then why would you need the photograph? Why couldn't the witness testify, as in this case, of what they saw, what they observed, what their comparisons were? Why would you need a photograph? If you say any testimony by the witness is admissible.
The state would be permitted to, I mean, it's about admissibility, right? And so the association's position would be that the state would be permitted to submit a photograph and allow the jury to draw its own conclusions as to whether or not that child was above or under the age of 13.
But that wouldn't exclude the other testimony by the witness, as I understand your...
That's right.
Okay.
I don't understand why a witness couldn't say, yes, that was a child somewhere between, and my definition of child is between the age of 4 and 8. You would say not permissible?
Correct. I would say that that's not permissible. And that's simply because of the inherent unreliability of one human attempting to estimate the actual birth year of another human being. It excludes, again, the innumerable intrinsic and extrinsic factors on the part of both the observed and the observer. Things like race, ethnicity, gender, heredity, poverty, nutrition, you know, other socioeconomic factors.
But it's okay. It's okay for a witness to say it was a baby. It's okay for a witness to say it was a toddler. Somehow when the child is out of the toddler stage, which is presumably at, what, 3, 4 years old, after that the witness can just say a child. That's all.
The association draws the line at using numbers. So any other sort of descriptions of their actual observations would be admissible, but attempting to ascribe a number to a particular person, and I agree with my co-counsel, Ms. Delplane, that even an age range is simply too speculative. Another piece of social science is that two pieces. One, people with disabilities are often presumed by their appearance and their oral presence to be younger than they are. And likewise, the own age bias that's discussed in Henderson skews actually harder when someone is underestimating age than when someone is overestimating age. And really, this entire discussion further underscores the point that if a multi-factor test were to be adopted by the court, really, subject matter experts, people who know better certainly than I, and better than any lawyer, frankly. And I will just say, I don't think you could find a human being in the state of New Jersey who has more respect for PJ Sabatino than I do. But still, you know, we need people who are scientists, who are neuroscientists, data scientists, social scientists, to work together with people who know our evidence laws to draft an appropriate test that captures all of these things. All of the different factors that might play in. Nonetheless, however, the association's position remains that the blanket prohibition on age opinion testimony should stand in this case, simply because age opinion testimony doesn't survive Rule 701. Because humans are so empirically terrible at estimating ages, essentially an age opinion by virtue of visual observation is not rationally based on the witness's perception. And more importantly, such testimony cannot assist the jury as to any fact and issue. And in fact, when it comes to children, with an accuracy rate of 33%, because it's more likely to be inaccurate than accurate, such testimony runs the danger of...
Let me just understand that. The 33% represents what? That you were asked to come up with the exact number for the child, and 33%... How is that possibly comparable to trying to decide whether any member of a group of children is under 13? I mean, you're actually saying that 33% of people would be wrong if they said a child was under 13?
I believe that statistic would work the other way, that 33% of people would be correct.
Would be correct. So, but what the data concerns, as I understand it, can you tell if this child is 6 or 7, and you get it wrong if the child's really 6 and you say 7? We're not talking about that here. We don't have a case before us where it was critical to find out if the child was 7. The only inquiry for the jury was one of these children under 13.
Had the the state not put on inadmissible evidence, I believe that we wouldn't be here. And inadmissible evidence on the only essential element, excuse me, inadmissible evidence is the only evidence on an essential element. Had it not been the only evidence on an essential element, we might be in the province of harmless error. But because it was the only evidence on an essential element of this crime, unfortunately, we run afoul of due process by A, permitting a conviction on the basis of inadmissible evidence, and then B, permitting the appellate division to rewrite the law mid-proceeding to sustain that erroneous ruling. And that is sort of my second point here. The association believes the defendants.
Ms. Simon, I'm going to ask you to try to wrap up your argument now, and if you could just touch on the second point quickly, please.
Of course. Thank you, Justice. Essentially, it offends the association's notions of due process and fundamental fairness to change the rules by which different testimony can sustain a conviction on appeal when there's nothing a defendant can do about it. So at the end of the day, the association believes that the blanket prohibition against age opinion testimony should stand, and that it's the best protection to protect the truth-seeking process in our criminal courts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Elson.
May it please the court. In this case, the appellate division addressed the issue of the admission of eyewitness lay opinion testimony based on the totality of circumstances that one child in a group of 12 to 15 children was under an age threshold of 13 years. The resultant well-reasoned opinion set forth a multi-factor test to ensure that lay witness opinion testimony based on firsthand observations can be presented to a jury while protecting a defendant's rights and interests. The test allows for a case-by-case factual analysis to determine the propriety of such lay opinion testimony. And the state submits that the appellate division's opinion should be affirmed. Despite any argument to the contrary, this case does not focus on lay witness testimony estimating the exact ages or exact heights of children to establish an element of this offense. Rather, the issue centers on whether an opinion can be offered as to whether small children playing on a playground under the supervision of an adult are under the age of 13 without any level of specific expertise. Utilizing the multi-factor test with the opportunity to cross-examine these lay witnesses, to present rebuttal testimony, and with the appropriate limiting instructions, this type of probative evidence can be presented to a jury without undue prejudice to a defendant and does satisfy the tenets of both Evidence Rule 701 and 403. I wanted to piggyback on issues that were addressed with counsel regarding the investigation done by police and whether or not they could have ascertained the direct proof of the children's ages, whether or not photographs could be taken. There's been an argument that essentially the police didn't do enough when they got there. The police did do an investigation, and they did an appropriate investigation. They were faced with responding to a call of an adult male in a park, playground area, exposing himself. The officer testified that when they arrived, the defendant was still there. He was still exposing himself. So not only are they now in the process of having to determine how to apprehend this individual, first they have to get him to cover himself in the presence of what is going on. They don't know what type of reaction they're going to get from him. They don't know if they're going to be, you know, easily able to apprehend him, whether they won't be able to apprehend him. So clearly their focus was appropriate on the defendant and not the children and the parents that were there. Officer Girardi did testify. It's in the transcript from November 28th, and the testimony is on page 72 and page 73. That by the time they were able to apprehend Mr. Drena, you know, get him in handcuffs, and the parents and the children had left the playground. It's not beyond, you know, general comprehension that not everyone, you know, it's certainly an experience that happens in Hudson County, they don't necessarily want to be witnesses when it comes to a crime. And certainly when you have parents with young children on a playground that, you know, the police arrive to apprehend someone, it's not beyond comprehension that they, too, would take their children and make themselves scarce. So there, it's not that the police were lax in not getting photographs of children or speaking to all of the parents. Simply put, by the time they were able to apprehend the defendant, the children and the parents were gone. The police looked for cameras. They looked for physical evidence. There was none to be had. So ultimately, what the state is left with in terms of being able to prove the element of this age threshold, that there were children present that were somewhere between birth and 13 years of age, were the observations of both AG, who was the young woman who called the police, as well as Officer Girardi. And their testimony, in the way it was admitted and presented, was appropriate and was reliable with regard to not only them advising of an age range of the children, but also they testified with regard to physical attributes and behavior of the children that they observed to corroborate what their age estimates were. As Justice Patterson mentioned earlier, the height of the children. AG herself, at the time that this occurred, was 17 years old. She was 5'4". And when she testified at trial, she indicated that the smallest child came up to her hip. Officer Girardi, 5'11", indicated that the smallest child he encountered came up to about his waist. So clearly that indicates smaller stature, indicative of young children well below this 13-year age threshold on the top. Additionally, they discussed the playground and the playground equipment, monkey bars and a slide and the behavior of the children. Additionally, both referenced the adults that were present on the playground without objection as parents, indicative more of children who are younger age that require parental supervision to go to the playground on an afternoon to play on the park playground equipment.
Ms. Ellison, can I ask you some questions about the procedure that courts should follow if it were to allow this type of evidence? When should there be a 104 hearing? Should it take place in every case or in certain cases?
I don't think this type of testimony would necessarily be appropriate in every case, so therefore there wouldn't necessarily need to be a 104 hearing in every case.
In which instances would there not be a need for a...
Well, for example, the issue with, as was discussed before, when you have children who are on sort of the older age of the spectrum, say, you have this type of behavior occurs at, say, a middle school dance or, a middle school youth group meeting. So you're talking about children that are 11, 12, 13, where visually, by, physical attributes or behavior, you don't necessarily know if the children are under 13 or 13. That might not be a situation where it's appropriate to permit this type of testimony.
So set aside the 104 hearing for a second. In a case like that, wouldn't you need an expert to testify and not a layperson?
I don't know that it would be a requirement to have an expert testify as opposed to having direct proof of the child's age.
Assume because you didn't have direct proof. Direct proof, you've jumped over a lot of hurdles here.
Correct. But I don't know that an expert is in any better position to identify the specific age of a child simply by looking at them.
So I'm focused on your example, which is a good one. If the estimated range is 11 to 13 years old, is it sufficiently reliable to allow a layperson to take the stand and testify to that, or should it be someone with greater expertise?
It may not be permissible for a layperson to take the stand and testify. Obviously, the analysis really needs to be sort of case by case based on the facts of each individual case.
Would you agree that it would be unlikely in such a case for a layperson to be deemed sufficiently reliable?
In the circumstance where you are buttressing up against that 13 and you're talking about possibly 12-year-old, then yes, it would be much more unlikely for layperson testimony to be appropriate in that type of a scenario.
And aren't there experts, take the area of child porn, child exploitation cases, where an expert is called to identify the age with greater expertise, greater precision, what have you?
And there, I don't necessarily mean to say that an expert can't always ascertain age. There may be, you know, things within, you know, a particular case, facts within a particular case, where an expert would be able to. I don't know that with child porn cases, you know, a lot of it may be dealing with, you know, the developmental, you know, physical development of a child may play into sort of what the expert takes into account. I don't know, you know, factually, it would depend on the circumstances of the individual case, whether the expert is able to make such assertion based on, you know, what the physical sort of presentment of the child is in that individual case, as opposed to sort of in a child pornography sort of context.
But that would be a case of photographs. An expert would be of no help in a case like this.
Exactly. There are no, obviously there were no photographs, and ultimately what the state was able to present to the jury, it does satisfy, you know, despite argument by counsel previously, does satisfy Rule 701.
You're familiar with the Massachusetts cases?
I am somewhat familiar, yes, Judge.
So the Massachusetts cases say that when a lay witness is talking about physical appearance, they should be at the extremes. So in order to ensure that the witness is not guessing, does that seem to be a fairly good, like, rule of thumb approach?
I would say yes. And in especially in context of these, you know, this type of a statute where we're dealing with not looking at specific age, we're looking at this threshold of 13 years, you know, anything, when you're talking children who are in grammar school, you know, prepubescent children in grammar school, there is sort of this physical characteristic gap in many ways, as well as behavioral gap and other things, that you're not going to see in a teenager, someone who's 13 or older, that are would be easy for, you know, a layperson to identify, not just based on, you know, I see you and I'm going to estimate you're 5, but based on sort of the totality of the circumstances and the observations that are going to lead to the estimation of age based on all of the things that the witness is able to see and to perceive. I would just conclude with the state believes that the multi-factor test set forth by the appellate division is appropriate. It affords the trial court the appropriate level of judicial deference to allow the court to hear all of the factors, make an appropriate determination based on all of the evidence presented, and the state would ask that the appellate division opinion be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Elson. Mr. Murawski.
May it please the court, the Attorney General believes this might be a good case of actually affirming the appellate division's opinion based on the opinion below. The opinion was so well reasoned and so well supported and provided an excellent framework for trial judges to apply going forward that this might be a good case to just affirm based on the opinion below. One point that hasn't really been stressed up to this point is that in Sanchez, this court said one of the factors in applying Rule 701, especially prong 2 of 701, is there any evidence that the state can use to prove its element? Well, here there is no other evidence. This is all the evidence we have. I mean, counsel says, well, just use a photograph. Well, you don't have a photograph here. The Attorney General agrees if there was a photograph, obviously that should be presented for what it's worth. We don't have that photograph. All the state has to meet its burden is the eyewitness lay opinion testimony of two people who based their testimony based on what they saw, not only from their view of the children present, but what the children were doing, who they were doing it with, and where they were doing it. This is something that it's useful to the jury for what it's worth. The jury doesn't have to accept this. There seems to almost be a presumption here that, well, if the jury hears it, they're going to be unduly prejudiced. It's not the case. This was fully vetted by cross-examination. It was fully stressed in oral argument that they of why they thought this witnesses should not have been believed. The adversarial system is fully equipped to deal with this type of testimony for what it's worth. It should come down to a question of the weight of the evidence as opposed to whether it's admissible or not. A blanket rule that this is never admissible would deprive juries and the state of potentially valuable evidence pointing to a defendant's guilt without any corresponding gain.
Mr. Murawski, if the court did not adopt a blanket rule, tell us when you believe it would be appropriate for 104 hearings to be conducted.
Well, a 104 hearing would be conducted if a defendant can prove that this isn't helpful to a jury, or not just prove, but at least make the argument that this is not going to be helpful to a jury under 701, and it's going to be unduly prejudicial under 403. Obviously, if a defendant could make that argument, then the judge should have a 104 hearing. And
so you'd leave it to the discretion of the court, case by case?
Yeah, it should definitely be a case by case thing, because what if it is a case of a baby in diapers and you have two witnesses saying, yeah, it was a baby in diapers. I mean, are we going to need a 104 hearing to say, yeah, they were under 13? I mean, it goes to, you don't need social science expertise for someone to say they're well under 13. They're a three-year-old. They're a five-year-old. I mean, an expertise isn't really going to help. I mean, in this case, you had one person saying three, another person saying six. Is it really likely that an expert's going to show up and say, you know what, they were both wrong. They were really 13. It's unlikely. When it comes to age estimates, especially at the extremes, lay opinion isn't all that much less valuable than expert testimony. I mean, expert testimony as to the exact age of somebody, I'm even skeptical an expert could really be of value to the exact age of somebody. An expert's going to be able to tell someone's 12 rather than 13.
Don't you do that? Don't you present experts looking at photos in child porn cases to do exactly that?
But can do it in more of an age range, a threshold. It's more important when you have that threshold. And yeah, you could say they're up to that age, but to guess like precise ages is difficult, especially in this context. And now, how would the experts view this evidence? The experts would be only viewing the evidence that the lay opinion, the lay witnesses saw.
No, not in this case, where you don't have the direct observation, in a case where there were physical evidence.
When there's actual physical evidence that they can evaluate, well, that would be different. That an expert could. But an expert seeing what the lay witnesses saw, it's unlikely that it would come to a much different result. They're not going to really add much more than what the lay... Now, if we're talking about precise ages, we agree that the precedent, as old as it is still useful as far as precise ages are concerned, or very nearly a precise age. Like in that old case, Ketchin, it said the question's not whether someone looked 16, the question is whether someone was under 18. Yeah, we agree with that. If you're talking about 16, 17, 18, the lay opinion is far less helpful under prong two of 701 than it is when they say they're 3 years old, they're with parents playing, and they're given context. And this is where the factors laid out by the appellate division provided very useful context, which, of course, last but not least, provided the totality of circumstances context, like an all-encompassing circumstance. I know that it was mentioned whether you could look at their clothing. Certainly none of these factors should be singularly dispositive. None of the factors should be required in every case. But it's a collective qualitative assessment based on what the witnesses saw, and given an age estimate, it is not unduly prejudicial. If they say it's five, the child's three or five, that could be useful to a jury. The jury could accept it or reject it based on cross-examination and the whatever the adversarial process can produce. But if the witness says, well, there are 12, well, then that's not quite useful to a jury at that point. It may not meet 701. And in fact, in that case, it may be unduly prejudicial under 403, but that would be a different case. But when you're talking about ranges at the extremes, like they say you can't even estimate ranges. What if someone said, well, they were less than five. They were definitely less than five. Under their construct, someone couldn't even say that. And that would be...
I'm sorry, finish your sentence, please.
Well, that would be depriving the jury of a very useful perspective. And even though they're lay witnesses, they're kind of like quasi eyewitnesses too. They're viewing the crime firsthand, and they're just giving a lay opinion about one aspect of what they saw. But they're eyewitnesses in what they did in fact see. Now, obviously, if they had photographs available, you know, that would help. We're not against making photographs available admissible if they are available. But in cases where they're not available, the state should be allowed to try to meet its burden with what it has. And it's up to the jury to determine what weight to give it.
Do you have a view on, if this evidence were to come in, the type of instruction a judge should give the jury?
Well, I think that
there's some language in May that speaks to the instruction. Do you recall that?
If you could direct me specifically to the language.
It said 595. The judge must specifically instruct the jury that the state bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the person was less than 16, must charge the jury that speculation about age is not permitted, and that the jury must be persuaded by the evidence that the threshold age has been proven.
That would be a very useful instruction. And we would also say that it should be requested by the parties. The judges, the absence of such an instruction should not result in reversible error unless it was requested by the parties. So if requested by the parties, an instruction along those lines would be very useful, because the jury, well, the instructions actually given here went a long way to instructing the jury that it really is up to them. I mean, witness credibility and reliability as to how long they observed it, how far away they were, all these factors come into play as to how helpful it could be to a jury. So certainly that instruction that Your Honor refers to would be a great start and could be the type of instruction that we could give. Of course, the Attorney General has no objection to presenting this to the jury charge committee for a charge, but we also believe that it should be instructed and its absence should not be considered reversible error per se.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, just that the appellate division's opinion, a very well-written and well-reasoned opinion, should be affirmed here.
Thank you. Ms. Delplane, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
No, I waive rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel.